Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's our regular home improvement show. And our topic today we're going to zero in a bit on is your home and climate change. And, of course, John Freiberger back with us, registered home inspector, more than 50 years of experience. John's firm is Freiberger & Associates, and they consult in restoring and adapting old homes and other buildings. And we want to hear from you. Have you noticed the hot weather affecting your home? What about more rain? Has that made a difference to your roof, for example? You can join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. John, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be back with you, Larry.
This climate change, we've talked a lot about climate change and we've talked a lot about home improvement, but I don't think that we've spent a lot of time talking about them on the same program. Why is it important that we talk about these two subjects together?
Well, climate change is affecting our houses. Mm-hmm. And what is happening in Wisconsin, we know from statistics from NOAA, mm-hmm. is that we have higher temperatures, right?
Yeah.
And we have higher humidity.
Yep.
The Gulf of Mexico is 3 to 5 degrees warmer than it was historically. That humidity heads up our direction, carried by prevailing southerly winds. So we are exposing our houses to more moisture. Now, we may not think of humidity as moisture. I mean, we do when we're outside like yesterday when it's 88 and we're sweating like mad. But our houses are affected by humidity because if we get condensation is water.
Yeah.
And water does not do well with houses, especially with newer houses. You know, my old house, your old house, were built of wood.
Yep.
So the studs were wood, the sheathing is wood, the siding is wood, you know, the lath behind the plaster is wood. It's all wood. And nowadays, houses are built of manufactured products, generally wood chips or sawdust that has been glued together. So it's a lot more permeable to water, and it decays or simply decomposes a lot quicker. You don't see any oriented strand board rowboats, do you?
No.
So we have now what a lot of people in the industry call was wood. You know, it was wood at one time, but it has been chipped up, reduced to smaller particles or fibers or whatever, and then glued back together. And that stuff is really, really has some problems when it's affected by moisture.
So looking at it that way, we need good moisture barriers, I would guess, to keep it away.
Right. And we need two types of barriers. On the inside of our house, we need to have a vapor barrier. That is something that is vapor permeable. And on most of our houses, since the late 60s, 70s, and then required by code starting in 1980, we have basically a plastic film. And plastic film stapled to the face of the studs with the drywall or plaster over it. And the theory is that in the middle of winter, when our house is maybe 40% humidity inside, that humidity will not go out into the walls through the vapor barrier. The problem is, usually it does. Well, you read the manufacturer's insulation instructions, and the vapor barrier is supposed to be sealed in all areas, including where it meets the floor. But the vapor barrier doesn't go through the floor. So we have moisture in the basement that is going up into the ring joists and up into the wall, and there's no vapor barrier there at all. So this can create a certain number of problems. The other barrier that we need is the weather-resistant barrier, which is vapor permeable. And that is going on the outside of our house. Now, on your old house and my old house, that was tar paper.
Yeah.
And tar paper is great stuff. Right? Basically, it was, you know, cotton, felt, saturated with tar. And what is weird about tar paper is that it is a smart membrane. When there's more humidity behind it, it opens its pores to let the humidity out. And when there's less humidity behind it, it closes its pores to keep the humidity in.
That's pretty cool.
It's absolutely astonishing. Now, DuPont and other companies are working on making smart barriers now because we don't want to use tar paper anymore. But some of these old things on our houses are make it so much more weather resistant than the new houses. So we'll have a product like DuPont Tyvek, or Kimberly-Clark make ones called Block It. Dow used to make WeatherMate, I think. So these are big sheets of fabric. And in most cases, they're stapled to the outside of the house. Now, Dow required using cap nails, which I think was a real good idea, because when you staple a Tyvek to the outside of a house, basically you're putting 5,000 holes in it. So now we have a water and wind barrier with a whole lot of holes, and that doesn't do well.
Doesn't do well at all, I'm guessing here.
Well, the problem we have with a lot of the wuzzwood is surfactants. So a little bit of moisture gets through, dissolves some of the acids. That then dissolves the water barrier in the Tyvek or the Block Set. So the little hole becomes a bigger hole becomes a bigger hole, and pretty soon the system fails.
So what do we do?
Well, we need to do a better job of installing the products that we have as new products come along. And the problem that I find is that a lot of this stuff is not inspected. So you get a building permit. The inspector comes out and looks at the framing. The plumbing, the heating, and the plumbing inspectors come out and look at the rough plumbing, heating, and wiring. And then inspector comes back later for final inspection. During that time, the Tyvek, I'm using Tyvek as sort of a, I'll call weather-resistant barrier. I shouldn't just call DuPont, use DuPont's name. The weather-resistant barrier has gone up, and the siding's gone up over it, so it can't be seen. Well, I see it because I see it loose at the bottom and other things. And what I find is 99% of the weather-resistant barriers are installed wrong. I only know of one house that I've inspected where it was installed correctly, and that's because when I inspected it the first time, I told him he had to tear everything off. And the contractor did, without arguing with me, and then he put on the WeatherMate barrier with the correct cap nails and sealed it to the foundation, sealed it around the windows, and I could find absolutely no problems with it whatsoever. And Larry, that's highly unusual. So why is it when the weather-resistant barrier is extremely valuable, essential indeed for our house, that it doesn't get inspected by the jurisdictions having authority with the building permits?
That's a good question.
Now, the insulation is inspected on the inside.
Yeah.
But I have condos here in Madison where we have a pretty good building inspection department. You know, there's some hardworking men and women in Madison. And I have five-story condos, three-story condos where there is no weather-resistant barrier whatsoever behind the brick and the siding. And the most recent one is only 5 years old.
Oh, boy.
So the builders, unfortunately, the unscrupulous builders, know what gets inspected and what doesn't. If it's not going to be inspected, sometimes it simply isn't there. And that really is a problem. We need to educate builders as to what they need to do. And we need somebody to hold them accountable. And, you know, when you're, I mean, you and I know a lot, but the average person who's a doctor or a dentist or a lawyer or whatever and is building a new house simply does not have the background to go to that house and inspect it themselves. They really rely upon the jurisdiction having authority to inspect it. And that really isn't happening anywhere in Wisconsin that I know of. I'll probably hear from somebody in some town who says, John, you're wrong. I do it. In which case, that's great. But even here in Madison with good personnel, I'm finding problems where I'm finding, Larry, literally million-dollar problems after the jobs are finished. And so you have condo associations suddenly having to write big checks because it was done wrong initially, and now it has to be redone.
So do we need to Do we need to have statewide rules? Do we need to, you said education for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, education is one thing. Now, if you're a contractor in Wisconsin, you have to be educated. You have a certain number of hours that you have to take every 2 years to renew your license. And some of the stuff can be covered by that. But it's not going to happen unless there's some accountability, and that has to come through the permit and inspection system. So I really think, you know, the Uniform Dwelling Code is there, Larry, and it says what you have to have. And the Uniform Dwelling Code says in one of the chapters, because I said there's a lot of different weather resistant barriers, it says whatever the manufacturer says, that's sort of included in the code. So an inspector who shows up and sees a DuPont or a Dow or a Bloxit Kimberly-Clark product is done wrong can say, look, code says this has got to be done right. Redo it. The problem is they're not looking at it. So it's not the code that needs changes. It's the number of inspections. We need to include an additional inspection or make part of the weather-resistant barrier part of the insulation inspection.
John Freiberger, our guest, and we're talking with him today and zeroing in on sort of climate and weather and your home all together. And we've started with a look at moisture and moisture issues. And Bill in Partyville actually has a question relating to moisture, a moisture issue, if I'm not mistaken. Let's go to Bill. Bill, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, Larry. I have a farmhouse that's over 120 years old. It's a Rockwell foundation. And I've changed the downspouts and resloped the yards. I still have some moisture problems in the basement. You can smell it. My dehumidifier doesn't take care of it. It's been suggested that I use a foam spray on the inside, but I'm reluctant and really not enough educated to know whether or not that's a good product.
Yeah, that's a bad product. What it is going to do is it's going to trap moisture and acids inside the wall. You have a 120-year-old farmhouse, so the mortar that is holding that wall together is a lime-based mortar. Soil's acids will simply destroy that. So we're better off at this point with the moisture coming through in vapor or occasionally probably in dribbles of water through this wall. And the best thing you can do is do as much dehumidification as you possibly can. You may have to buy, you know, a pretty good quality dehumidifier, and people need to be warned. There's dehumidifiers and there's dehumidifiers. There's huge differences between efficiency in dehumidifiers, and good ones cost some money. Of course, they save you money on the electricity bill every single month. So it's best just to let that wall breathe. You've done what you could with the downspouts, which help. They should be as far away from the house as the basement is below grade. So if it's 6 feet up to grade, you want the downspouts 6, if not 8 feet out. The other thing to take a look at is to look at the drainage around your house. Sometimes it's impossible to change the drainage because you're going to, if you add soil, you get too close to the siding and you want to have 8 inches up to the siding. But if you can, we want to have a quarter inch foot slope for the first 10 feet around the house. So that's 5 inches of drop in the first 10 feet. So that also can help. The other thing to check is go outside when there's a big storm and see if your gutters and downspout are handling the rain. So another problem with climate change is we are getting heavier rains, larger volumes in shorter time. And I'm finding that I'm looking at a lot of properties where they have water in the basement, and I ask them to look at it in the rain. They go, yep, the water's coming right over the top of the gutter because the downspout's too far away. So either we have to add downspouts or we have to have bigger gutters. So the gutters aren't doing what they're supposed to do to collect water. Or they'll have a gutter helmet on that relies upon surface friction. The water flow is so heavy it shoots right over the top of the helmet. So take a look at that as well. Make sure that your gutters are actually collecting the water and your downspouts are getting far enough away. Improve the grading if you can, and just leave the basement alone.
All right. And if the brick in the basement, I've heard you talk about this before, on an older home like that, you need to be careful about replacing are fixing those breaks if they become loose.
That's correct, Larry. If you have an old farmhouse like mine or like Bill's there in Partyville, you want to use a lime-based mortar. And people can always go to our website, Educate Homeowner, and download the instructions for lime-based mortar for using on old, not only old foundation, but old brick and stone above ground as well.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News with my guest, John Freiberger. Taking a look at your home today with John Freiberger, registered home inspector of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. He comes by every couple months to talk with us, so it's great. And you can join in again at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Just a quick mention, at 12:30, a fire inspector joins us to talk about how to prevent fires at home. You know, just going along with what you were talking about with gutter covers, Colleen in New Holstein emailed us. She's used two different types of gutter covers, and both seem to have a lot of rain run over the gutters as well as going into them, and wonders, are there any brands or types of covers that you recommend?
No. And it's Larry, not because they're all bad. It's the gutter helmets are great if you don't have a lot of rain. But they're great because you don't have to clean the gutters. They keep the debris out. My house, I've got these giant maple trees. I spend a lot of time on a ladder, and it's terrible. I'd love to have a gutter cover that worked. If I use the type that is basically an expanded wire mesh so that water runs through it rather than over it when there's a lot of rain, the problem is all my maple seeds sit on top of that as well. So it really depends upon the circumstances you're in, what exactly is your house like, how big is your roof. So if you have short pitches on your roof or you're never going to get a huge amount of water coming down, well, then the gutter helmet may work just fine. But if you've got a Victorian where it's 20 feet to the top and you've got masses of water shooting over the top of your gutter helmet, it doesn't work. But maybe there's no trees, so then you can use more of the mesh type. So you really need to talk to a specialist in your area, explain to them your concerns. And one thing about being educated consumers get a lot better service than uneducated consumers. If you're asking the right questions and asking for a guarantee, the contractor is going to treat you with more respect and think a little bit longer before they sell you a product. So there's none that I recommend because it's all site-specific.
Okay, I wanted to talk about warmer weather. We're getting warmer weather, and that obviously has, I think, over time, an impact on the home.
Yes, it does. And one of the things that happens in our older houses is we do not have our houses. Older houses are not air sealed, so you can have a lot of air movement moving up from the house into the attic, especially in the winter. And in the summer, you can have air from the attic moving into the house. And attic air is often pretty doggone dirty. You may have some mold. You may have a dead mouse. You could have all kinds of things in that attic. And if your attic is not well vented and that sun hits your roof and the attic is going up to 120, 140 degrees, that air is expanding. If it can't get out through the vents easily, that air can actually get pushed down into your house. And plus the heat is going to make your ceilings a lot hotter. It's going to work its way through the insulation. So if you have an older home or even a newer home, we really need to make sure that we have upgraded the ventilation in your attic to the current code standards. And some of those standards really worked well when the code was written. So Larry, with a code, you can do nothing but soffit vents on your house, as long as you have the right percentage of open area to the shingle area. The soffit vents is code compliant. The problem is that doesn't work anymore. So because our attics are getting so hot, and you'll see a lot of houses, older houses, when they're re-roofed being switched to ridge venting. And the ridge venting really is the best because the ridge of the house is the hottest part of the house, and there are our air is coming out. But we have to make sure our soft vents are open as well. Now, you may walk outside your house that is 80 or 60 years old, you bought it 10 years ago, and you see vented soffits. Well, what's above the vented soffits? Well, it could be solid plywood. You could have no soffit venting whatsoever. So now you've got air leaving the attic at the ridge vent, not coming in through the soffit vents because they really don't exist, so it's being sucked out of your house. So as it's being sucked out of your house, more air is entering your house through the walls. So we have hot, humid air going into the walls of the house where it can then condense in the interstitial spaces. So we really need to study our venting. We need to really have somebody come and inspect our house, which can be a home inspector or an insulation specialist. We need to have high venting to let air out. We need to have soffit vents to let air in. And we need to have chutes in the attic. Because if we have soffit vents and they're plugged up with insulation, then we have limited air movement. So the increase in temperatures in Wisconsin really require us to make sure our attics are well vented.
Nick in Green Bay has a different kind of question. So let's go to Nick. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, I just want to say one quick thing before my question. I used to listen to you, but it was more just interest. Well, we closed on a house 6 months ago. Now I really listen to you because you're so educated. So, but my question for you is, we got a house, it was built in the 50s, and we get a 50-50 chance of getting a hot shower. Do you have a hypothesis that that water heater is going? And how hard is it? Can I replace that myself? Do I need a billing permit, or do I need to be certified or anything like that?
You really want to use a plumber. Now, the first thing, Nick, is figure out how old that water heater is. On most water heaters, not all of them, you're going to have a serial number. And generally, the first four letters of the serial number are going to give you an idea of the age of it. So let's say the serial number begins with 1287 and then a bunch of other numbers. That means it was manufactured the 12th week of 1987. In other words, it's older than the hills. The other thing to think about, Nick, is new water heaters are going to be much, much more efficient than your old one. I'm assuming your old one is probably chimney vented, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's what we call a self-cooling water heater. So there's a hole that goes up through the middle of that water heater. And the idea is when the fire turns on, the heat goes up through that hole and it helps heat the tank, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've got continuous convection up through there, though. So in the winter, it's taking cool air off the basement floor, and it's convecting up, cooling the tank, and then sending that air up the chimney. Well, then you've got a self-cooling water heater. So then you've got to heat it up again, which causes more convection, which causes it to cool, so you get this cycle. So I would take a look at a power-vented water heater. They have really increased in price, unfortunately. A lot of them are $2,400 to $3,400. But you'll save a lot on your electricity, and a good plumbing contractor can tell you how much. Take a look at Focus on Energy, see if there's any rebates in your area, because it depends upon your utility. The other thing to think about, although it costs even more money, is basically a heat pump water heater. Either of those are going to be great for the environment. It's going to eliminate your natural gas with the heat pump, and it's going to save you on utilities. So do some research, but do hire a professional to do it.
Okay. There you go, Nick. Thank you very much for calling. Jeremy in Mineral Point, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jeremy.
What's going on, y'all? I got a quick question. My wife and I are getting ready to close on a home. We just completed inspection, and we got a long list of things that came back. And it's stressing us out, y'all. I just need some feedback, insight, like, where do you put priority into things that can be fixed now, right, versus things that can be put off for a bit, you know what I'm saying, so you can transition in and still be happy and still feel that excitement of moving into your first home?
That's a real good question for your home inspector. Because most of them, Jeremy, are pretty well educated. And generally, different inspectors use different software from different companies. But in Wisconsin, all of them have to have a summary. And it has to list things that are defects, things that are maintenance. I'm forgetting all the things. And different software has slightly different things in them. But if there's a defect, that's something you really need to take care of, because the definition of a defect is something that can cause further damage if not taken care of. So I would read that report really carefully. And then you may want to call the home inspector or email them and say, okay, give me a little bit more information on some of these. Because some of the software does not really give you all the information you want, but the home inspectors are generally happy to give that to you with a follow-up. So I would certainly start with the home inspector and see if that gives you a certain amount of comfort, allows you to come up with a schedule of priorities. Does that make sense, Jeremy?
It does. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. You mentioned dehumidifiers earlier, and Bob emailed, where do you find good, efficient dehumidifiers for your basement?
Good question. I'm going to have to think a little bit. Usually, there are ratings on all appliances, including dehumidifiers. So it's going to give you an idea of the energy usage. And the other thing it's going to tell you is how many pints of water it can take out at certain humidity levels over an hour. So you should be able to go online and get that information from the manufacturer and then compare them.
Makes good sense. John emailed us, and this relates to another point you brought up. Regarding gutter toppers, why don't you just skip rain gutters at the roof line altogether? Catch rain in troughs buried on ground level. Easy clean out and easy channeling away from the foundation. Obviously, you need roof line diverters over doorways.
Yes, if you can contain all that water. We have to remember 2017, we had a bomb cyclone. Here in Madison, we got 15 inches of rain. I believe Mesomene got 21 inches. I don't think we're going to contain that kind of rainfall. And this is one of the things that climate change, Larry, is we're getting more rainfalls in excess of 2 inches in a couple of hours than we used to. So our defenses are tending to get overwhelmed. So we really need to, as we talked earlier about adding soil, adding drainage, whatever we can do, making sure our gutters and downspouts are the right size, we really need defense in depth, considering what climate change is doing to rainfall in Wisconsin.
Jim in Kenosha County will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jim.
Larry, I hope I didn't miss what's already been discussed about dehumidifying, but with all our rental properties we take care of, and including my 100-year-old basement, most basements have a floor drain, and we just keep a off-the-shelf dehumidifier, and instead of using the tank or a throw pump, we just have you have the hose option. You run it into the drain, and Bob's your uncle. You just run that thing, and about the time you might need to start your humidifier in the winter, you know, you obviously mm-hmm. turn it off for the winter, and it's efficient. There's one basement, we have two of them going. Sometimes you can enlarge on it, but usually for the most efficiency, it's usually when you just have one clicking away, kind of like air conditioning. You don't want to oversize your air conditioner because it doesn't have time to dehumidify your space.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a small one clicking away all summer, it's going to get your humidity down.
Right. And almost all dehumidifiers, everyone that I've seen, at least Jim, does have that hose option. Sometimes you have to look inside, and it's a little bit difficult to get the hose hooked up. But for almost anything you're purchasing nowadays, you're able to download all the installation instructions if it doesn't come with it. And the other thing that is, and maybe you already do this, is that we have a humidistat on the dehumidifier. Sometimes they're accurate, sometimes they're not. You know, having a separate humidity readout on the wall is not terribly expensive nowadays, and that's a good idea to really know what the humidity is in your basement or inside your house, because some of the older dehumidifiers, you know, as things go on over the years, who knows whether they're reading accurately or not. And there's a big difference between 40% and 50% humidity in a basement. It's a difference between having mildew and mold and not.
Yeah, so 40% isn't a bad level.
40%, I think, is sort of the maximum.
Okay.
And certainly with my old stone foundation, I have exactly the same thing as Jim. I have it going into, well, not into the drain, but into the sump pit. But likely as not, that dehumidifier is running most of the summer because our old stone foundations breathe a lot.
Yeah. All right. Jim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, and email to talk at WPR.org. Kurt emailed us, what's the best way to insulate the floor on an overhang cantilever?
Yes.
The soffit is metal. They have stuffed in fiberglass insulation, but that doesn't seem to be very effective.
Right. Most likely what's happening there, Kurt, is you are getting a lot of airflow through there because you have no air seal whatsoever. And if this has an overhang, this might be a, you know, 1950s Dutch colonial or something with a 18-inch, 16-inch overhang. Could be a California shed contemporary with a 2 or even 3 foot. And basically what's happening is air is going up in there. So what I suggest on these, if you've got metal, you can take the metal down, and I really like spray foam. So spray foam is doing two things for you. It's giving you R5 to R7.2 per inch, depending upon the product you use. It's got to be closed cell. And it is giving you a wind barrier because it basically, it's gluing itself to the wood. So it should be wind impermeable and should have a great reduction on your thermal loss. And I would probably treat an overhang the same as an attic.
Hmm.
And I would want a minimum of R38, and preferably I like R50. But a good, high-quality foam installer should be able to take care of that for you, Kurt.
There you go, Kurt. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, it's kind of odd in a way to be talking about cold right now because it's pretty warm and and nice, but if you think about climate change, the weather, the temperatures probably, at least in Madison, don't seem to be getting as cold, to my thinking, as they were. But there are some really dramatic temperature shifts. You do see that.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that, that the weather services, NOAA and others, are looking at is, when I was a kid, I never heard of global jet stream wobbles. But it seems that these wobbles are wider and wider now. You know, sometimes the jet stream is right in far, far northern Canada, and it's in the middle of Russia. And other times it's far, far northern Russia, and it's in the middle of Wisconsin. And we're getting these big storms with wind chills 20, 30, and 40 below zero that are lasting for a couple of days. And it seems that what is happening with climate change is that things like the jet streams are being pushed around a little bit more than they used to because we're getting high pressure areas from warm air, and suddenly you get something, what, over Alaska, and then the jet stream is suddenly down through Alberta and through the middle of Green Bay before it goes back up north again. So we're getting some blasts of cold in the winter, even though our average or our mean temperature is 3 to 4 degrees warmer than it used to be Fahrenheit.
So what's the result in terms of our home?
What's funny, because we're getting more, it seems like we're getting more pressure from heat in the summer, and we can get more pressure from cold in the winter. And I always thought that the winds were increasing, but strangely, checking NOAA, Wisconsin winds are not increasing as an average. You know, if you look at the, but are we getting storms now where we're getting wind events where maybe it's a little calmer other times, and so the winds are still the average speed, but when we get the global cyclones coming through or the bomb cyclones in the summer, that we're suddenly getting massive wind. And I see, you know, living in the country where I do, I see wind. And I could swear that it's windier, even though the statistics say that, that it isn't.
Well, Doug in Mount Horeb has a question for you. Let's go there. Doug, hi.
Hi, great program. I've got a 30-year-old Wausau house, 2x6 studs, fiberglass insulation. It was built, of course, at the factory with a very heavy, clear plastic barrier that was applied to the inside of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the outside is vinyl siding.
Mm-hmm.
30 years old. It's been wonderful. We've had no problems with it of any kind. The vinyl siding is finally giving up the ghost. We're happy that it lasted 30 years, and mm-hmm. so we're talking to two contractors about putting vinyl siding on again. They're both Nary contractors, very reputable, big name in Madison. One of them says, you already have a vapor barrier on the inside of that Wausau house. I'm not going to put Tyvek or any other vapor barrier on the outside because that will introduce a mold problem in your wall. We'll just put the new vinyl right over the old plywood because the plywood has no mold, it's not black, and it's clean. The other reputable contractor, again, big name, says, no way. You need to put a vapor barrier on there, and I'm not even sure I'd do the job unless I put a vapor barrier on. And they're both adamant.
Okay, Dan.
You're going to break the tie here?
Yeah, well, no. No, they're both wrong, but it could be Dan not using the correct term. So we definitely have a vapor barrier on the inside. So vapor barrier stops vapor, right? It's vapor impermeable. Vapor can't get through it. And the idea there is that the humidity in your house can't get into your walls and condense during the middle of winter. On the outside, we do not have a vapor barrier. We have a weather-resistant barrier, which is vapor permeable. So if we talk about Tyvek, Bloxit, Housemate, any of these manufactured ones, basically their job is, number one, stop the rain. Number two, stop the wind. Number three, if there is moisture inside the walls, it can go out. So what I would do on a house, now a Wausau home, you are fortunate because basically you had something that was built to standards in a factory with a certain consistency that we often don't get with mm-hmm. custom-made homes in the field. But what I would do is I would remove that existing weather-resistant barrier and I would replace it. Yeah, DuPont Tyvek is fine. Housemate is perhaps even a little bit better. What I really like about the Housemate, which I believe DuPont bought from Dow, is what I like about it is they insist that you use cap nails, not staples. So take a look, go online, take a look at the various ones that are out there, and some of them, I can tell you, have much better installation instructions than others. I'm not going to name the ones that are bad. But I can tell you that the DuPont and Dow stuff seems to have the best insulation instruction. But tell the contractor that you do not want staples, you want cap nails. And read the installation instructions. The other thing you're going to find is that it's supposed to be sealed to the foundation. Now, your house, being a Wausau home, it maybe actually is sealed right to the bottom of the ring joist. But on a new house, with the one exception, I've never found it correctly installed. So I think probably there's a little mix up in terms here, but I would go with the contractor that is going to replace it, make sure it's tight. But you want to make sure that you read the installation instructions. A lot of times I just coming down to the studio, I drove by a house that has Tyvek on it and has Vicor tape around the windows. Well, that has voided the DuPont warranty on that house because they used the wrong tape. And builders, for some reason, don't know this, so therefore consumers have to tell them. So, Dan, I'd start with Tyvek, take a look at the DuPont installation instructions, download them. I would say print two copies, hand one to the builder because they may never have seen it before. And then as they're doing it, make sure that the windows are taped correctly, the doors are taped correctly, and it is sealed properly at the foundation. So you had a house that was probably a little bit better built than other things that were field built at the period, and you want to try to maintain that differential.
There you go, Doug. Thank you very much for calling. John Freiberger, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. John Freiberger, our guest today as we talk home renovation. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson is back. She'll be answering all your questions about growing plants in Wisconsin. Right now, though, we're looking at your home, and Pat in La Crosse has a question, so let's go there. Pat, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 100-year-old or a turn-of-the-century home, and we've had two summers, and this is going to be the start of the third, of little no-see-ums to get through and into our home. We've never had that before. It's kind of just started. We put new screens on with the small, little, tiny holes. But do you have any other suggestions? Because they're still getting through.
Yeah, they could be coming right through the walls. And that can be a difficulty. I mean, older homes, as we were talking earlier, Larry and I have got tar paper on our houses, which is great stuff. But, boy, it sure doesn't stop insects. So little things can get behind it. What you may want to do is try to come up with a little bit of science. So you can do an energy test on your house where you actually measure how leaky the house is. So what you have is an energy person comes in and they put a big fan, they seal your front door and put a big fan in it, calibrated to 50 pascals, and then they depressurize your house. And when they depressurize your house, they can tell you, number one, how many cubic feet per minute is it leaking? And then they can use little indicators like smoke candles or little gauges, and they can go like around the windows or around the baseboard, and they can go, oh, here's a big leak. Here's another big leak. Here's another leak. These are things you can seal from the outside. So I have a feeling it's the same thing in my old house. I've done things really carefully, but the lady beetles just swarm in the fall. It just happens on older houses. But I'm gradually making progress on it as I do sealing on the outside. So you may want to start by calling an energy inspector and just say, I need to have a infiltration test done. Because if the air is coming in, the bugs can be coming in as well. Does that make sense, Pat?
Yep. Thank you so much. Never thought of that.
Yeah. You don't have a new dog or anything, do you?
Nope, we don't have a new dog, and we've had those clouds of new seams that, you know, around the, because we live along the river. But this is the first, 2 summers ago was the first time they've ever come in the house, that we've ever had issues.
Well, I think it's, and that test is going to tell you a whole lot.
Indeed. It's going to help you, right. It's not going to just help with the bugs, as Larry is suggesting. It's going to help figure out what you should air seal and what you should better insulate as well.
Yeah.
And again, check with Focus on Energy. I don't know if there's any rebates for energy inspection. Every utility seems to be a little bit different.
Yeah. There you go, Pat. Thank you very much for calling. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Hey, John. John and I spent some time in Clearwater, Florida, over 10 years ago now at a home inspection conference. And so I'll start with what we learned there. Depending on what part of the country you're in, up in the north, we put vapor barrier or a plastic film on the inside. And at the time, vapor barriers were put on the exterior in climates like Florida.
Right. Yeah, that is correct. It's where is your highest humidity? And certainly in Clearwater, Florida, our highest humidity is outside the house, even often in the winter, where here in Wisconsin, it is inside the house. But you are quite correct. But we've only got Wisconsin Public Radio here, so... of course, we have to take a look at Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code, which is, you know, the sum of what the experts really know, and the code gets revised every couple of years. But you are correct, Mike. And then there's the middle climates that they talked about. So if you're in the middle of Tennessee, do you need a vapor barrier? Well, maybe you don't. But here, interstitial condensation is a big problem in Wisconsin. We get a lot of sick house syndrome due to mold and mildew inside the walls because we've got vapor inside the wall and it's condensing, turning to moisture, getting onto cellulose like the back of drywall and creating some nasty situations.
Mike, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patrick in Madison, your turn. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm just curious. I've got a 1-inch foam board behind my siding that I'm thinking I want to just reuse it. Not sure if that's really a good option or if I should just plan to replace it.
Question for you, Mike. Do you know if there's anything behind the foam board? That is, I mean, obviously there's the plywood or OSB, but is there a weather-resistant barrier, like, you know, a Tyvek or something behind the foam, or is the foam itself your weather-resistant barrier?
No, it's there's a Tyvek wrap on it as well.
There is. And is it behind the foam or in front of the foam?
Oh, it's behind.
Good. Wonderful. Wonderful. There is no reason not to reuse that foam. Now, if you've got some areas that are broken, you cut them out and you patch in a new piece. But then what I suggest you do, Patrick, is tape all of that foam and tape it to the windows as well. What you're going to have then is you're going to have a double weather-resistant barrier. So if there's any flaws in that Tyvek, which we know has a million nail holes in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's go ahead and turn the foam into a second weather-resistant barrier, and let's not... There's no reason at all to replace it as long as it's closed cell foam. It shouldn't be the white stuff. It should be the pink or the blue. It should be the extruded, not the expanded. But go ahead and reuse that, replace as necessary, and you get a good foam tape. It probably says right on the foam who made it. Might say Dow on it in, you know, Dow letters or something. And then get the right tape on it and then put your new siding right over the top of it.
Patrick, there you go. Thank you for calling. And Loretta in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Loretta.
Yeah, hi. I had a humidifier on my furnace. It stopped working well.
Mm-hmm.
And do you recommend humidifiers on furnaces or not?
Oh, that's a really a particular question. Generally, no. And that is... Loretta, because most of the houses I'm involved with, we get them sealed tight enough that we don't have all of the air loss. Now, if you've got an old house and it's really leaky, in the middle of winter, what's happening is that warm, wet air is leaking outside and really cold, dry air is coming in from the outside. So that what is happening is that air change is decreasing the humidity in your house down to, you know, like 25%. Where, you know, you get a shock if you walk across the carpet and touch the doorknob. But generally, if we have our houses fairly tight so we're not getting those terrible humidity drops due to air change, I would simply not bother with a humidifier. Now, what I would do is stop using it and get a humidistat down to your local hardware store for, you know, $12 or $15 or whatever, or order one from Amazon, and track the humidity in your house. Now, if it never goes below 35%, that's great.
Yeah. All right.
Save money.
You'll save money. There you go. Thank you, Loretta. And Gene emailed. He's having an issue with a door leading to his garage not staying shut unless it's locked. Does the door need to be replaced, the trim, the lock, or something else?
Okay, Gene, the first thing to do is take a look at the edge of the door and see if it's fire rated. If it's not a fire-rated door, and if it's a fire-rated door, it has to have a label on it, and it'll say 20 minutes. It's sort of weird. Wisconsin Building Code says we have to have a one-hour wall around our garage, but the door can be 20 minutes. But 20 minutes is what you want. If it isn't a 20-minute door, let's replace it just for safety. If it is coming open because it isn't locked, it probably means that there's excessive leaking because the door and the jams aren't close enough together, and that little, the little catch or latch that's connected to the doorknob is simply not seating well. Now, you could probably repair that. You could bring the plate out, something like that. But my guess is you've got an older door, and it might be just good to replace it with a good insulated fire-rated door. It's not that they're terribly expensive, and it's something you actually can do yourself.
Thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it, Gene. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. John Freiberger, our guest today of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. And he'll be with us right up till 12:30 to answer your questions. In the meantime, we'll take a look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today. We're taking a look at home improvement with our regular guest, John Freiberger. His firm, Freiberger & Associates, is based in Fitchburg. Do you need some help with a home improvement project? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Lines are all filled right now, but they'll open up. And you could also email to talk@wpr.org. Doug in Mount Horeb, I think, may have misunderstood. We may have misunderstood what John had, what Doug had to say. So let's go there to Doug in Mount Horeb, our earlier caller. Doug, we got you back.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, you did misunderstand it. Just one piece. I'm the guy with the Wausau home, 30 yep. years old. Okay. So it has a vapor barrier on the inside.
Right.
It does not have a weatherproof barrier on the outside. So the one contractor says, you need one. The other one says, look, you've had it for 30 years. The plywood is clean. There's no mold. I'm not going to put a weatherproof barrier back on because if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Leave it the way it is. I'm putting vinyl on.
Yeah, if you take a look at the installation instructions from the Vinyl Siding Institute, most likely last updated 2022, the Vinyl Siding Institute will tell you that vinyl siding is a rain screen. So it's like a window screen. It stops most of the water, but some water goes through it, and it is designed, if you look at the bottom of your pieces of vinyl, they have little holes in them to drain the water out. So the Vinyl Siding Institute is going to tell you that your vinyl siding should be installed over a weather-resistant barrier. So that's sort of like the word from on high. So the other problem is Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code, which applies to remodeling. You have to have a weather-resistant barrier. So a contractor who's telling you you don't need one is advising you not to follow the Uniform Dwelling Code, and I don't think I'd trust that.
All right. There you go, Doug. Thank you so much for calling. Now let's turn to John in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. What can we do for you?
I have a question. I've been reading a couple articles on Google about spray foam insulation, and they're not liking it?
Mm-hmm.
Am I misunderstanding that?
Some people don't like spray foam insulation. I like it as long as it's put on correctly. Now, spray foam insulation has to be correctly mixed so that you don't end up with an incorrect expansion. There are different types of spray foam. Spray foams that have different levels of expansion. There are places where you have to use low expansion spray foam, say around windows and doors or your ceiling between the jamb and the rough framing. There are places you should not use spray foam, such as over basement walls, because you have vapor pressure is going to push it off. You can't use long, long sprays of spray foam because it shrinks and goes into tension. It can peel off long sprays. So when you're using spray foam, you need to do a little bit of studying. You need to use the right foam. You need to use a contractor who is really competent.
Yeah. And if you do that, you're going to have good success.
You should, yes. The odds are certainly in your favor. And what I like about it, we talked about the person that had the jetty or the overhang on the second floor of their house, is a nice thing about spray foam is it's both insulation barrier, vapor barrier, and wind barrier all in one.
Yeah.
So it is expensive compared to other things, but it is often covering three problems, whereas simple fiberglass or cellulose may only be covering one.
John, there you go. Thank you for calling. Charles in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Larry. Great topic. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what your guest thought about heat pumps and, you know, their utility instead of furnaces or air conditioners and, like, their impact on the environment.
I'm very much in favor of heat pumps. The prices will come down on them a little bit. Right now, the main problem is expensive. There's air-to-air heat pumps. I've installed ground source water heat pumps as well. I like them for heating. I like them for cooling. I like them for water heating. I like them for everything. And at some point, we are probably going to get a lot like Europe. And we are simply going to phase out all of this gas equipment because of long-term pollution. So do your research, check with Focus on Energy, see what may be available for rebates. But anyone that can switch a gas-burning appliance out for a heat pump or for a low-efficiency electric air conditioner is bless them.
All right. Charles, there you go. Jamie in Algoma, your turn. Hi, Jamie.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling regarding the lady who had no-see-ums in her house. I would encourage her to make sure she has a positive identification on the insects. I know the entomologist you had on before say all the little buggies are really hard to know what they are for sure. I'm thinking they might even be drain flies or fungus gnats on a house plant. So before she goes through all these expensive tests, make sure she knows what the critter is she's dealing with.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Point. A very, very good point, Jamie. Thank you for calling. And something to think about for sure. Dan in Fitchburg, we go to you. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John. I have a home that I'm working on as a handyman. They added an exterior door that's only 4 inches above grade. Can't be changed because it's a condo association. There's not going to change the grade. And the issue is that when they installed the door, the installers did not provide finishing at the bottom of the door. So I can see an inch of membrane. It was properly membraned coming from underneath the door sill down an inch and then out 2 inches over the 2 inches of on insulation and the parge coat of the foundation insulation. So my question is, in order to provide something that looks attractive and that can be stepped on for that exposed inch or so where they're going to be stepping up from the soil into the house, what can I do? Can I remove some of that insulation and provide new membrane that will still waterproof it and provide a fascia board? Or do I have to, because that would be below grade, the membrane would be below grade to meet the removed insulation below grade. Currently, the insulation is a couple of inches above grade. Or do I have to do something like a aluminum angle iron to preserve the insulation and not mess with what's already there?
Is it possible that you could use AZEK or another PVC product to fill the space and to work sort of as a kickboard?
I'm not familiar with AZEK.
Well, you're familiar with LP, right?
Yes.
Okay, and LP, of course, would dissolve there because it's not 6 inches above soil. So AZEK is basically PVC, so it's the same thing as a waste pipe, right? So AZEK, just take a look at it online. I find that a large number of kick plates and other casing and other things around doors are simply, they're too close to grade. And AZEK is the solution for almost everything because you can literally bury it. So take a look at AZEK, a little bit more expensive than LP, but, you know, a lot more lifetime and a lot more forgiving as far as low-grade work. And that may be your solution.
Yeah, that sure may be. Dan, thank you for calling. Good luck with that. Appreciate it. Joe in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good afternoon. My son, about a year ago, bought an old farmhouse, probably from the 1880s it was built. Over the winter, we noticed that it's pretty leaky. So I'm having a home energy audit done on the home. And I just wanted to see if there was any guidance on the person that's coming in does home energy audits, but they also obviously do all kinds of other insulation and services of that nature. So I just wanted to get some guidance on, you know, what I should be listening for and, you know, once we get the recommendations come out, how to prioritize what to do.
Yeah, it's a really complicated question, Joel, and a very smart one to ask, I must say. As I'm, you know, my house is 1851, so a little bit older than your son's, but we certainly run into a lot of problems. So we have a lot of air intrusion on houses of that age. We also have no vapor barrier. So the question is exactly where do you start? And I guess you start with the energy audit, and they're going to give you an idea of what the conditions are. But then the problem is designing, is how do we design insulation systems? How do we design wind barriers? How can we install a vapor barrier? Unfortunately, we see a lot of people buying old houses, and they put cellulose in the walls, and there's no vapor barrier. And all of a sudden, the cellulose is wet. And all of a sudden, the walls are rotting. And that can really be a problem. So get what you can get as far as information from the energy analyst. Make sure that you express to them your concerns about how to retrofit an old house, because it is not particularly simple. Since you're in the Madison area, if you need a little bit of information from me, feel free to email me. And we can maybe discuss this further. I do a lot of things for public radio people without charge, as long as it's not taking more than an hour or so. But you're making the right first step. But then what the second step is going to depend upon several different things.
And how do we reach you again, John?
The email is frei@chorus.net. Chorus spelled like a group of singers, C-H-O-R-U-S.
Chorus.net. Not net. Joe, does that help?
Thank you very much.
All right. Appreciate the call. And Carrie in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Carrie.
Yes, thank you. I would like to ask, John, I am building a new four-stall garage. It's going to be roughly 56 by 28, 2x6 wall studs. What would be a better, stronger sheeting? OSB, you know, the 4x8 sheets, or half-inch plywood. I don't really like OSB. And one more question, Why have windows gotten to be so darn expensive?
Oh, yeah, isn't that astonishing? For a good quality window, it's just absolutely amazing. I just bought a few wood windows at $2,500 a piece.
Oh.
Pretty astonishing. There are some options out there from Pella and Weather Shield for non-wood windows. They're still expensive, but certainly with windows, Larry, you get what you pay for. And the people with vinyl windows that, you know, buy two, get one free, and newspaper ads, circulars, stuff in your mailbox, well, those windows have a 20-year life. And, Terry, it sounds like you're building for 50 years. Yes, certainly if you can afford the plywood, it is a superior product. It's not going to make any real structural difference. You can, if you're in an area where you're maybe taking a lot of wind in Green Bay, like you're up on the bluff or something like that, you could add a few more nails than usual, nail it every 6 inches. That makes your entire garage a shear wall. And then be very careful when you put on your weather-resistant barrier that you properly detail it. Again, if you use DuPont Tyvek or Dow WeatherMate or something, read the installation instructions and make sure you do it right, sealed at the bottom, wrapped underneath the sheathing. And I think that's about all I can. Does that cover it for you, Terry?
Yes, that sounds pretty good.
All right, great.
All right, thank you very much for calling. And on to Alex in Princeton. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, great. We have a 100-year-old farmhouse, and we have a shed roof in the back, which is kind of a sun porch, and we like it. We don't want to take it out of there. However, it's leaking. The roof is leaking at an area where it comes, where it joins the house.
Mm-hmm.
One gentleman told me that the room is sinking, and that's what's causing the leakage. However, we would like to put something at the joint there to prevent the water from coming in when it rains.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you could suggest?
Well, you're going to have to talk to an intelligent contractor, because most likely, if this is a 100-year-old farmhouse, it probably has either rosin paper, which is sort of a red paper, and it's all going to be crinkled up and shrunk now, or it has tar paper, which is better. The problem with tar paper is that nothing sticks to it. So what you may find that you're going to have to do is take off some siding, lift up carefully the tar paper if it's there, use a flexible tape, Vicor or something like that, behind the tar paper, over the top of the metal flashing at the edge of the roof, and then put the siding back on. But you're going to have to find a knowledgeable contractor who can put that together for you. I'm trying to think of a place online that would give you a good detail, but one is not popping to mind. But it's very important that if there's tar paper back there, that we not damage and destroy it, and don't try to stick something to it. We have to stick something behind it.
Okay.
I hope that helps a little bit, Alex.
Does that help, Alex?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Tanya in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question. I'm finishing up a new build, and they are going through the final inspection for occupancy. My question it seems like there's this trend going where people are foregoing inspections. Is that something that I'm thinking about, that is it usual to have like a final independent inspection even after the certificate of occupancy in a house? It's my first experience with a new building.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand the process.
Yeah, well, fortunately, you're in Madison, and I said before, the Madison inspectors are quite professional, but there's half the number that they really need. And things do get missed. I think we talked earlier about weather-resistant barriers often not being correctly installed. So what I am really suggesting to people, despite the quality of the work of the Madison staff, is I would get a home inspector to come in and check, because a home inspector is going to do things like check the weather-resistant barrier that the city inspector really doesn't have time to look at. So I would take a look at the various associations of home inspectors. So there's the Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors. There is InterNACHI Association of Home. But you look at home inspector associations, people who are members of associations tend to care more and are more professional. So like you go to WAHI, Wisconsin City Home Inspectors, look through it. Unfortunately, they don't give you a lot of information. You know, some people we know specialize in new houses. Some like me specialize in old houses. And it doesn't tell you that. So you may have to do a few emails and say, look, I have a new build. I want to make sure things are really tight, and I want to get a good inspection. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the Madison inspectors are looking at code issues. So if the cabinets really aren't installed right, or the window trim is done in sort of a sloppy way, or the LP siding is just plain wrong, that is not something that they are inspecting. That's not in their purview. It's not in the code. And I'm finding a lot of issues with siding and trim. And a home inspector is going to pick that up where that really isn't the business of the city, the municipal inspector anyplace in Wisconsin. So I would go ahead and spend the money. It's going to cost you from $300 to $500. But it may be a very good insurance policy for you, Tanya.
Yep. Does that help, Tanya?
That's super helpful.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And by the way, Jill wanted to remind us that we're having a lawyer on the show next week. It's on Tuesday's program, and we'll be talking about legal issues with condos and HOAs. So some of what we talked about today may relate right to that.
Be prepared for a high volume of calls, Larry.
Oh, man. Dean emailed us. Has a 1923 brick Craftsman bungalow off an upstairs bedroom. There's an attic space about 6x12 that a previous owner insulated with fiberglass and thin paneling. Started a leak in the ceiling, so they removed all the paneling and insulation and now just have the entire roof replaced on the whole house.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need the space, but Dean's afraid the bedroom may be too cold. The ceiling and walls are 2x4. Can he screw some 2-inch Syro on the studs and ceiling, or he would foam tape and the edges.
Well, it sounds like we probably have a ceiling above this bedroom, so that may be a good place for high-quality insulation. I think I would call a good insulation contractor, Dean. I don't know what city you're in, and hopefully you've got a few options. So that call two or three people and ask them how to treat it. You really want a minimum of R38 on the ceiling above that bedroom. I don't like the idea of applying foam directly to the rafters, because we can it can be done, but it has to really be done right. But we could end up with entrapping moisture, because remember, we need to think about thermal barrier and vapor barrier at the same time when we're separating our house from an area that is not conditioned. So talk to a couple of contractors. One of them is going to make more sense than the rest.
Makes good sense. You know, home building science has changed and it's probably going to keep changing over the next few years. Maybe to be able to make building materials and homes that face these new conditions that we've been talking about today.
We have a lot of wonderful new materials. And actually, Larry, most of the materials we have right now, I mean, there's nothing wrong with OSB. It is what it is. It is making use of every fiber of a tree. You know, unlike our old plywood or our wood studs, where sometimes, I mean, you look at the waste in the lumber yards in Wisconsin in the old days. We had wonderful wood, but God, there was a lot of waste, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is these products have to be installed correctly. And the big problem, the problems that we have is keeping moisture away. And so our interior vapor barriers and our outside weather-resistant barriers really have to be done correctly. And that's where we need to educate our builders. And as I said earlier, I really think we need to change Wisconsin inspection.
The dwelling codes.
Well, the dwelling code, it's not just the dwelling code, it's what gets inspected. And we really already inspect the vapor barrier, but we really need to take a look at the exterior weather-resistant barrier before the siding or whatever cladding is going on goes on.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Are we going to see some adjustments for climate change? I mean, sort of in the long range.
The Uniform Dwelling Code, as I said, I think it's basically updated. Well, there are emergency updates, too. I mean, 1 year, there were like six different updates because of wind loading. And so we are definitely seeing changes in the code already, because the original code, if you take the code from 1980 and look at it, it's this little half-inch thick pamphlet. There really wasn't much there. And we've added a great bit to it. And then Wisconsin also has the code commentary, which is another couple hundred pages of discussion of the code itself. So the state of Wisconsin has really done a wonderful job of upgrading the code. And I'm glad we don't use the International Residential Code, because that, as Mike said earlier, is built for Florida, it's built for Tennessee, and it's designed for Wisconsin. Wisconsin has its own code, and I think in the era of climate change, that is something we want to make sure that the state keeps, and it simply needs to update it. But inspection and quality control are the big problems in the construction industry, and it causes no end of grief. So remember that we always have home inspectors, and most of them are pretty well educated. I'm doing my very best to give as many seminars as I can to educate them. So if in doubt, call a home inspector, tell them what your problem is, find the right person, and have it inspected.
On that note, John, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure. We'll see you in a couple of months.
Be glad to see you again in 2 months.
John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. And by way of full disclosure, I should mention that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. Great to have him with us today. And coming up, we'll take a look at home fires and protecting yourself from them. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller. You know, summer is a great time to gather around the campfire or start up the grill, and it's also a great time to brush up on your fire safety skills so you can enjoy those activities without being worried about it. Larry Mueller here talking about fire prevention and safety today with our next guest on the show, Jason Connect. He is a fire inspector with Eau Claire Fire and Rescue and can answer all your questions about fire safety in the home. And I hope you'll join in. Let us know how you're preventing fires. What's your escape plan in the case something goes wrong? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. Jason Connect, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for allowing me to come in and talk a little bit. It's a great opportunity.
Well, you're a fire inspector. What are your responsibilities as a fire inspector?
Yeah, that's correct. So I actually have two roles in the Eau Claire Fire Department. First one is code enforcement. We have about 6,400 routine fire inspections in the city of Eau Claire. So what I do is I assign those inspections to the individual fire trucks and ambulances to do them. And then if they have any issues or recurring problems or that kind of thing, then they forward that information to me and the other fire inspector, my partner, Shua Bauer, and we'll follow up on those. We are actually busy. The two inspectors here are busy doing, like, plan review of new construction, doing testing on sprinkler systems and testing on fire alarm systems, going to schools with public education schools and nursing homes and that sort of thing, public events. And then our other role is if there would be a fire, then we also investigate that fire for the cause, so hopefully we can prevent that. We're both certified fire inspectors or fire investigators, so we investigate all fires within the city of Eau Claire.
How'd you get started in this field?
Actually, I personally got started as an explorer, division of the Boy Scouts, back in 1990 in the Altoona Fire Department, which is a small town right next door to Eau Claire. And then I, when I got old enough, I joined the fire department in at the same time, and then went through training and been involved ever since.
Oh, that's pretty cool. David in northern Wisconsin already has a question for you, so let's go there. David, hi. Thank you for calling from northern Wisconsin. David, are you there?
Oh, hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I just recently installed a wood stove as a backup to the gas-fired stove that I have in case you needed it. But I'm wondering about using it 24/7 throughout the wintertime. How safe is that, using a wood stove for your heating?
Okay, how safe is a wood stove?
It actually is very safe as long as it's installed correctly and the proper maintenance is done. First of all, it's got to be installed with the proper clearances away from the walls and other combustibles like furniture and other stuff in the house. But then also the vent pipe, the chimney, that has to be a properly installed pipe. It's got to be a double-walled pipe. And as long as that entire system is installed correctly, it's a wonderful thing. I love wood stoves myself. I grew up with some wood stove heat. It's great heat. And then you have to take care of the maintenance as well. You got to clean the chimney every now and again, every couple of years, to make sure that that the pipe all the way out is clear and not obstructed. You also have to make sure you use dry wood, dry fuels. If you use something other than wood, some people like to burn their garbage in their fireplace or their wood stove, which you should never do, because all of that residue goes up inside the chimney, and it collects, and it creates creosote. Well, the creosote eventually will build up so much that it clogs the pipe, and then you get chimney fires. So as long as you burn dry wood and wood only and do the proper maintenance, it's a wonderful thing.
All right, David, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I know that smoke detectors are something you wanted to talk about today and maybe talk about why they're so important, especially when it comes to fire-related deaths.
Absolutely. Smoke detectors, they've been around for many, 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 many years, and that's really your only warning of a fire inside your home. They take a little tender loving care. We always say change your batteries. when we change our clocks, which is twice a year. But the biggest thing is to have working smoke detectors in the home. There's been several fires where there's been deaths because there's been no early warning. There's been no warning whatsoever. And by the time you realize that there's a fire, it's almost too late to get out. So have working smoke detectors in the home. They should be placed at least on every floor, one on every floor, and then somewhere in the hallway or near the sleeping quarters, near the sleeping areas, and then inside each bedroom. So, for example, if there would be a fire in the basement, hopefully that basement one would go off, so you could hear that. But by the time the smoke gets upstairs, maybe there that would activate the one on the first floor, so you'd have two going off. Anytime you have anybody sleeping in the home, you have to have working smoke detectors. But don't put them in the kitchen or near the kitchen or near the bathroom, because in the kitchen, sometimes if you're cooking like I do, sometimes I burn things, not on purpose, but sometimes the smoke, if you burn a pizza or something in the oven, sometimes that'll activate the smoke detector. And if it keeps going off, it's almost like a boy cried wolf kind of situation where it keeps going off, you're going to get less sensitive to it. So, and eventually you might say, oh, this darn thing, and take it down. So stay out of the kitchen and then avoid the bathroom as well. Because sometimes if people take hot showers, we've went on false alarms where the steam from a hot shower will set the smoke detector off as well.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, make sure you have them. If you have batteries in them, a lot of detectors nowadays, you can buy them with a 10-year battery, so you don't have to worry about changing out batteries, but they still should be tested. What I do at home with my boys, I got two young boys. I got a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old. Sometimes when daddy's cooking, we'll have a fire drill if the smoke detectors go off, and we'll practice having a fire drill at home, you know. You should always have an escape plan at home, too, and we can talk about that here in a second. But I can't stress enough where smoke detectors will save lives. It will give you that early warning so that you have the minute or two to get out. With today's furniture and the way we build buildings with wide open spaces and synthetic building materials and furniture, all of that stuff produces really nasty, thick smoke and really bad chemicals when they burn. And they burn faster and hotter nowadays than they did 20, 30 years ago. So just a couple breaths of that smoke is really, really bad. In fact, that's probably going to kill you if you take a couple breaths of that smoke. So the earlier the warning, the better. And we do that with working smoke detectors.
How common are home fires these days?
They're becoming fewer and farther between. We don't have as many, but when they do, they seem to be bigger. Simply because of a big contributing factor is no early warning, like no working smoke detectors, and then the synthetic materials that we're using nowadays with polyurethane foam and that kind of stuff. You know, like grandma's couch, that was all cotton. Now, today, it's rare to find real cotton in your furniture. So when that burns, that gives off chemicals, and it burns faster. So a lot of times, you can't get out. People are becoming more aware. You know, there's state laws in new construction that require smoke detectors. Or most insurance companies, when they buy or sell a home, they require working smoke detectors. So it's getting better, and the actual average fires are going down. The occurrence of fires are going down. But when they do, it seems to be really bad. Like back when I started in 1990, man, we were going on all kinds of fires. So they don't happen as often anymore, which is great, but they still happen. And when they do, some people get caught in them, and that's what we want to avoid.
You know, it's about 12 years ago now, when I purchased a house, I did a complete remodel, kind of from start to finish on the inside, and it's a three-story. So we put a sprinkler system in. And I was like, oh, that's kind of expensive. But then I checked with my insurance agent, he said, oh, that was a good idea. Your home insurance just went down in cost. What do you think about sprinkler systems, especially in a home like that?
They are wonderful. In fact, I wish we had a residential sprinkler system law in Wisconsin. It's been tried several times, but it gets shot down. They are the best thing. It's like having a firefighter living with you. I mean, by the time you realize there's a fire, the sprinkler system is already activated. And, you know, a couple things that it's kind of my pet peeve, where Hollywood, you see on TV or you see in movies, that if somebody pulls a fire alarm, the sprinkler system goes off. Well, we know that's not how it works. Or if one head goes off, they all go off. And that's not how it works either. Each system is designed to only operate about with 10% of the sprinkler heads activated at any given time. Only the heads that are closest to the fire will activate. Insurance companies are really realizing now, and it's taken a long time to educate insurance companies, that they used to jack up your rates if you had a sprinkler system. Like, oh my gosh, all that water damage, if a pipe sprung a leak, oh, that's going to fill the house full of water. Well, that's actually cheaper. I mean, the chances of that are rare. I mean, yes, it could happen, and it has, but the chances of that are very rare. And then the water damage is way less than fire damage, because it's not only the fire damage, but it's also the smoke damage that creates a problem. So I know several people that have sprinkler systems in their homes. In fact, my former fire chief and former assistant chief have them in their homes. And you do get breaks with the insurance company. What that sprinkler system does, it keeps that fire from spreading, keeps it from getting bigger. So say you get a fire in a wastebasket for whatever reason, it'll keep it in that wastebasket, or at least in that room. If it doesn't contain it, it'll certainly put it out, for sure. That's why we have laws like that in commercial buildings, but I would love to see them in residential occupancies as well.
Steve in Oshkosh will give you a chance to join in. Steve, thanks for calling.
I live in a fairly large apartment complex, and every time somebody burns their toast or a pizza in the oven, their fire alarm goes off, and then everybody has to evacuate. And then the fire department has to come, and they search every unit you search all over the building to try to find out which unit it came from. I'm wondering if there's a better way. Is it possible for a smoke alarm to let the department know which unit the fire is in?
There's not really technology that would notify us, like it's in apartment number 2 or something like that, a very specific location of the building. Once we get to the building, sometimes, depending on the fire alarm system that they have, it will notify us. Like, the detector in apartment 2 went off, so then we go there and check it out. If they don't have that type of system, then whoever burned their toast should stand outside and wait for the fire department to show up and say, yeah, I did it, I'm sorry, it's not a real fire. But if the fire department shows up and nobody tells them or says something, or if the fire alarm doesn't articulate which apartment it is, then we have to go around and search for whatever the problem is. That'd be nice. If you could invent that technology, you'd probably live on your own island somewhere. That'd be great.
Oh, Steve, thank you for calling. Our guest today, Jason Connect, a fire inspector with Eau Claire Fire and Rescue, as we talk with him about fire and your home. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Thanks for joining in today as we talk about fire and fire prevention with our guest, Jason Connect, fire inspector with Eau Claire Fire and Rescue. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234. I wanted to talk about extinguishers for just a minute. How well do they work? And should you think about keeping one in your home. And I bet a lot of people have them in their home and couldn't put their hands on them in a short period of time because they're probably stowed away somewhere.
Yep. Unfortunately, they get if they do have them, they get put away. Or sometimes what's really common is they put them, I'm going to keep this handy, they think, and put it on top of the fridge. Well, then pretty soon other stuff gets on there, like boxes of cereal and, you know, whatever, and then it gets pushed to the back, or they put it under the sink. The best place, first of all, you should have an extinguisher, and they work really well. The main thing is to get out, to get everybody out safe, and then if it's safe to do so, then maybe you can try putting the fire out if it's very small, using an extinguisher. And when you use an extinguisher, always keep the way out to your back. Never put the fire between you and your way out if you're going to use an extinguisher. And if it's anything bigger than a small pot in the stove or a small wastebasket, I wouldn't even worry about it. Wouldn't even try it. But extinguishers work very well. Keep them in a handy place where they're out of the way, so you're not going to bump into it or knock it off the wall or whatever, but then in a place where it's still readily available, not under the sink or not on top of the fridge, mounted on the wall in the corner somewhere or on the side of the cabinet or, you know, somewhere where it's readily available but not going to get jammed up with stuff around it so you can't get at it when you need it.
I had on my home, I had the air vents going out, and I had this sort of louvered system on the outside. And what I found was when I was getting the house painted, the house painter said, you got birds coming in and out of this one vent. And he took out about 3 feet of lint, even though I cleaned the trap all the time. So what I did was I installed a wire thing over the top that lets the air out but also keeps the birds out, and that improved. And I was just thinking about, as a way to prevent a fire in the home, making that dryer vent clean is probably one good thing.
Absolutely. That is a very common problem and a common cause of house fires. A lot of people, they don't clean their lint traps after each load. If they do, they don't think about the pipe from the dryer to the outside. That pipe, that vent pipe, should be cleaned at least once a year. And you can do that with the wire mesh like that to keep stuff or birds or animals and stuff to come inside. But then also you can buy kits at hardware stores and stuff. You can use a drill to use a brush to clean it out, or you can hire a company to come and clean it out. But those pipes should be cleaned at least once a year as well, because every little nook and cranny or every dent or every little corner where it bends, that's a place for lint to collect. And eventually, it'll collect up so much that the dryer can't vent off that heat, and we'll start a fire that way as well.
Oh, okay. Tom in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, I've been, I've owned homes for many years. I got an extinguisher on every floor. I've got my alarm systems and all that stuff. But I was watching a video a few months ago. I believe it was an older video of Senator Elizabeth Warren at a hearing. And she was talking about toaster fires from back in the 60s before toasters had mandatory timers and they had to eject the toast. Do you or your guests have any concerns about our current atmosphere of deregulation and getting rid of consumer protections?
That is very true. Back in the 60s, there was a major swell in fires caused by toasters and other kitchen appliances. That's why nowadays we have like UL-listed and tested appliances where they test those timers and test the off switches, you know, like automatic coffee pots. That was another appliance. Toasters were an appliance that would, as long as it was held down, it was always going to be on. There's also rules and regulations that created those timers. Nowadays, with manufacturers that make those appliances, I don't think they're going to take a step backwards if there ever was any sort of deregulation. I don't think that they could afford the liability if they did. Now it's just a standard thing that that they have those fail safes in there. Every now and again, once in a long while, they'll fail, but it's rare. It's very rare that, those fail safes fail. So I don't think that's really an issue now. If there would be deregulation today, maybe, you know, in 10, 15 years, you might see something, but I don't really foresee that happening. I certainly hope it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. Karen in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I got a question regarding fire extinguishers. You see videos online about this fire blanket. Are those effective and worthwhile?
The problem with fire blankets is that it has to be a perfect application. So you have to get close, number one. So you're actually taking time to find the blanket and then unpackage it and then throw it on the fire. And the idea of the blanket is that it smothers the fire, takes the air out of it, starves it of air. To do that, you have to have a perfect application and cover the entire fire. So if you're good at it and practice it, you can probably do that. However, it's probably easier to grab an extinguisher and blast it at the fire instead of using a blanket. But in some applications, a blanket would certainly work. But like I said, it's got to cover the entire fire. Otherwise, it's not going to do any good.
Mm-hmm. And in terms, you talked about practicing fires, if something happens, if you have a fire in your home, everybody gets out, but there should be a place to meet, shouldn't there?
Absolutely. What we teach kids in school, and we teach everybody, is anybody that'll listen, is when the smoke detectors go off or there is an incident in the home, go outside and then stay outside, no matter what. And then have a safe meeting place that's away from the building, the driveway, the mailbox, a big tree in the yard, swing set, whatever. Pick something that everybody knows where it is, and then no matter how they get out, everybody meets there. The first thing we're going to do is ask, is everybody out of the house? If not, then that is our main priority, is to go get that missing person. We had an incident many years ago now where a child... elementary school child was just taught to, if you can't go out in the hallway, if there's smoke in the hallway, to go out the window. So he went out the window, and dad was sleeping on the couch in the living room, and he went out the front door. So son is in the backyard, dad is in the front yard. They both said, "Where's dad?" or "Where's son?" And then they went to the other side of the house. So son went to the front, dad went to the back, didn't see him. The son knew enough to stay outside because he was just told to stay outside no matter what. But dad went in to look for his son, and he ended up perishing in the fire. So if they had a safe meeting place, that wouldn't have happened, hopefully. So as long as everybody has a safe meeting place, and then you can do a head count of who's here and who's not and figure that out real quick.
Wow. We've scratched the surface here, Jason. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I hope we can get you back, because there's other things to talk about for sure. I was thinking about barbecuing and cooking safety tips, but we'll save it for another time. In the meantime, thank you so much, and I look forward to another visit. Appreciate it, Jason.
Absolutely. I would love to come back anytime, and thanks for the opportunity today.
Jason Kinect, fire inspector with Eau Claire Fire and Rescue. Sounds like they've got a good person there in Eau Claire, for sure. And we'll get him back and do it again. Thank you for listening today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producers, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, but hey, please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.